Hello and welcome back to Inside Total Film. It's the weekly podcast that lets you know about every new release you need to know about. I'm Jane Crowther. I'm the editor-in-chief of Total Film. And with me today, I've got Jack Shepherd.
Hello.
Hello, Jack. And also Matt Matem.
Hello.
Hello. And this week, we'll be taking a look at Calm with Horses and chatting to the cast of that film. We'll be taking a spin around the floor with And Then We Danced. We'll be delving into the controversy of The Hunt and hoping for world peace with Misbehaviour. But we won't be appraising Vin Diesel's new film, Bloodshot, because they haven't shown it to any critics.
Why would a film not screen for critics? That's what I want to know.
I know. It makes you wonder whether there's something wrong with it.
I wish I had the answer.
I can't imagine.
I have no idea why.
Anyway, let's get started with this.
Most people know to stay on the right side of the Devers family. I'm what you meet if you ever find yourself on the wrong side. People say they're trouble, the Devers.
I didn't get the joke, Lex.
But I say all families have their problems.
I don't want him to be around you because of the things that you do.
Wise up, Arm.
Wise up.
Yeah, wise up.
You were never like this before, you know that? Before them Devers got their hands in you.
That was Calm with Horses, which I saw in TIFF a long time ago, and it was my favourite film of the festival. Matt, you also saw it.
Yep.
Tell us what this is about, what we can expect from this film.
Right, so Calm with Horses, it's set in rural Ireland in the fictional town of Glanby, but it's kind of set on the west coast. And the time's vaguely indistinct. You know, it's roughly modern day, but they never really make it super clear exactly when it's set. And it's basically at its heart kind of crime story. You've got the Devers family that's this big sort of crime family into drug dealing and things like that. And there's the young man in that family, Dimpner. Mm-hmm. And he's got an enforcer who goes by the nickname Arm, who's his kind of muscle, basically, who dishes out all the beatings he needs dished out. And it's basically looks at these guys, like Arm's the main character we follow, really. And it's just this kind of little microcosm that we follow through these guys, really, and how they're trapped by their circumstances and what they might do to escape. And that's the very basic setup of the film.
You talk to the stars of the film, Cosmo Jarvis and Barry, I don't know how to say his name.
Barry Keoghan.
Thank you. Yeah. I want to be sure we say that correctly because there's lots of interpretations around. You met with them this week.
Yeah, I met with them yesterday and had a chat about all things relating to the film and their characters, which was nice. And yep, learned how to pronounce Barry's name because he saw actually on my notes that I had scribbled a sort of phonetic reading of it because obviously I didn't want to mangle his name on the podcast. And he, yeah, just clarified that it's Keoghan. I kind of was led to believe it was Keoghan. Keoghan, yeah,
and I think I've called him Kogan for quite a while, so yeah. I'm glad we've cleared that up. Let's have a listen to what they had to say about this film.
If you guys could just give a bit of a setup by explaining your characters and how they fit into this story in Calm with Horses.
I play a character called Arm, who works closely with Barry's character, Dimpner, who is part of a family called the Devers, and the Devers are involved in some criminal activity, and Arm is an employee of theirs who does basically whatever they ask him to do.
Dimpner, as Cosmo said, he comes from the Devers family, and has a lot of pressure on him, coming down from his uncles, and you know, and his father was a very well respected man. People fear him in the town, and he puts Arm in a difficult spot because he's torn between, you know, whether he wants his family or whether he wants, you know, this kind of life.
And yeah, so you guys obviously mentioned the Devers family there, and it's set in rural Ireland, kind of all centering around this family. So what kind of research went into these roles for both of you?
So it's an interesting question because, like, it sounds silly, but there's research and there's research. And I guess obviously there were some things to do with regards to like boxing and what kinds of things that the people who this story might be based on were involved in. Even though it's complex and specific to its area and its circumstance, it's actually very simple, the story. Yeah. It's very family orientated, and all of the questions that it raises, I mean, as a reader of the script, I didn't have a hard time understanding what was at its core. There wasn't really much. It was a lot to do with just, other than things like accent and stuff like that, there was other stuff like just being there at the moment and being open to these other characters in the work of like Barry and Neve or David Wilmot and Ned Dennehy, whoever it was. And so everybody was kind of just trying to find the truth in those moments. And yeah, there's not necessarily a lot of a lot you can do to prepare for that.
Yeah, Cosmo's right. Like, it's a pretty straightforward story. Obviously, a lot of layers to it when you break it down, but it's fictional, you know. But yeah, so it's not that much research to go into the story, but it's just like any other character you play. You find the bones and you find the skin of it, and, you know.
In a lot of ways, people, even though people are very different from each other, they're also very similar to each other.
Yeah.
So as much as you can get, like, you know, you had your work you did on Dimpner, like how he walks, how he talks, and all of that. And I had my equivalent of that work. But ultimately, by not judging these characters, we're all capable of doing anything, regardless of our character. And it was just a case of trying to just be there and play it, feel it for how it was at that moment.
Yeah. And Cosmo, is it true that you stayed an accent for the whole time and kind of even Niamh Algar, your co-star, didn't realise you weren't actually Irish till the end of the shoot?
I don't really know how else to go about, you know, when you have to do that as part of the work. I don't know another way of going about it other than trying to maintain it for as long as possible in the hope that it becomes something comparable to second nature, or even first nature would be ideal. So yeah, it's just each to their own, and that's how I come about doing it.
And Barry, is it true also that you kind of didn't want to particularly build a bond with Cosmo before shooting started because of the relationship between these guys?
I think it was the opposite. I wanted to get to know Cosmo more. In the movie, we're like brothers.
Yeah.
You know, we hung out a lot, and that was very intentional to hang out with him. Yeah, and also we're all in this hotel, and we're all, you know, it's
seeing each other every 5 minutes.
Yeah, so, you know, it was just nice to kind of hang out and get to know each other. But the film just felt like, you know, the cameras came about and just filmed us. It's a low budget movie, and with low budget movies, you know, you get this magical thing of you can't differentiate the real world from the fictional one, and it just kind of becomes one.
Yeah,
you know, and that was that for me.
Yeah, it's like a really good thing about it, like lower budget or like independent stuff, is that there is this, like, there to a certain amount they're open to what might happen.
Yeah,
like it's not necessarily it has to be.
You know, call times and all of this jazz, and you know, and I think it was great for the movie.
Yeah, Nick is very open to being perceptive to something that he might only just see there and then, you know. It's something that he's never closed to anything. And if a new darling is recent, like newly discovered, he'll kill an old one. And, you know, he's that kind of dude.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you mentioned that's Nick Rowland, the director. And this is actually his first feature film, but it's incredibly assured debut.
Yeah.
So, yeah, what did he bring to the table as a director?
Patience.
Patience. And, you know, from working, obviously, with other directors, and me and Cosmo's worked on other films, you know, you kind of have, you know, first-time filmmakers want to kind of tick all the boxes. That can slow a lot of stuff down or whatever. But Nick was very precise in what he wanted. And, you know, he didn't want to, you know, follow the whole routine of I need to get this, you know, a big check. Like, he was just very go with it, you know. He just knew what he wanted. And, you know, he knew how to let the actors, you know, have that bit of freedom and space. He was very, very nice to work with. He has a vision, and you see that in his short films. That's what really brought me on board with this movie. But you see that vision and that rawness that he's able to capture, and them, you know, them little moments that some people sometimes miss.
For somebody with a vision like the kind that he obviously has, he doesn't assert it in a way that you think that you would expect somebody who's clearly such a craftsman to assert it, but he has his way of doing it in a very, like, he's very emotionally perceptive, especially with his actors, and he takes you with him in a way that doesn't feel like you're being beaten or you know, it's very mutual and very, he wants the best for you want the best for him.
Like, that movie's almost like the day in a life, you know. You're just kind of thrown into the west of Ireland there, into a small town, and he's able to bring that about, that story.
Yeah, totally.
Which is very, you know, to keep you engaged and wherever. It's a very tough thing to do. It's just to take a small fictional little story here, throw in the west of Ireland, and keep you engaged.
And aside from the way that he's handled everybody's emotional, all the characters' emotional arcs, and aside from the way that he's made sure that has a credible soul to it and is executed in the best way, he also has managed, along with Damien, who's production designer.
He was great, Damien, as legend, well, wasn't he?
Like, made this whole world, you know, like from the locations to the stylings of the houses, like everything feels like it has been there for a long time before the film starts, you know.
And it very much kind of feels like, you're talking about it being universal before, and you're never quite sure what time it's set in, almost. So it kind of could be.
Which is great, because then that factor of it can become distracting of, you know, oh, well, this is set in this time. Why didn't they just so-and-so? Or why didn't they, you know? And with this, it's very clever in that sense. You know, I think you see a mobile in it. It's my one, and it's like it's a small Nokia, but they're up to like 10, 15 years old, them Nokias. Yeah. So.
Yeah, and Nick was always like, he said from as early as I was started to meet him that he wanted it to be relatable, which is exactly what he's done.
There's also in this film another key thing between the two characters is the car, the Toyota Corolla, affectionately nicknamed
the Shitbox.
Are we allowed to? Shitbox.
Nick is a rally car, ex-rally car driver. I don't know if you know that. So he's very specific on what car he wanted. And
again, it's like the action that occurs is not shoehorned into anything, and it's like. Yeah, but when we were filming that stuff with the car, you knew
it's one of the best chase scenes going.
It is an absolutely blinding car chase.
Yeah, and isn't it?
Nick was loving it.
I actually think he was kind of not as impressed because he's like, we're all like, oh, whoa, wow, the speed. Like, yeah. He's like, yeah.
It's like just another day at the races.
He wasn't giving anything away,
No.
And he was telling me things like, yeah, when you know, you got to feel what the car's telling you in your bum. You've got to feel it.
Really?
So, you know, you feel the road in your ass as you're getting that. you tell he knew what he was talking about.
Yeah. And didn't you film it in a day as well?
Yeah, that sequence, yeah.
So that was amazing, that.
Amazing stunt team.
Yeah.
They were amazing, obviously. Like,
yeah, they were really
such
cool.
Pros.
And so how did that actually work for you? Did you have another driver? Was it on the roof or was it next
to
you?
He was to my left.
Oh, okay.
And with the real steering wheel, I had a bogus steering
crazy.
Wheel. And I was kind of like catching his gear shift. We had a system where like, I asked him like, you know, if I could see him out of my peripheral vision changing gear, then I would delay what he did and do it after the gear shift was free.
Mm.
So we had this little system where I would just kind of do what he was doing after he did it. So that was cool.
Yeah, it looked really, really good. I loved that chase scene.
I think Nick compared it to Maggie driving at the beginning of The Simpsons. Is that how you felt?
yeah. That's exactly what it was. Yeah. It's Maggie with the dashboard steering wheel.
And Michael Fassbender has actually supported this film as a executive producer. Have you guys had any kind of... Did he support you in any direct ways? Did you speak to him at all?
He's actually from Kerry, where I live. Like, it's funny enough... He's literally 2 seconds from where I live, and I'd be down the pub having a pint with his father, and that, like, you know what I mean. So for him to be on board, it was like a very it was nice, man. It was really nice. Like.
Yeah, like especially like with some of the work that he's obviously done in the past. I met him for the first time the other day in the Dublin screening. Yeah, so I've got to shake his hand.
When I found out he was on board, I was like, yeah, I'll sign me onto that.
And what can you guys say about what you've got coming up next?
You finished one in New York there, right?
Yeah.
How did that go?
It was small, like same.
You had to lose weight for that.
Yeah. It was a small movie by a guy called Tim Sutton called Funny Face. So just did that. It's done. And now I'm just looking for work now. That was at the Berlin Film Festival. But now
was it? Did it premiere already?
Yeah. They showed it at the Berlin.
Did it go down well?
Mate, I don't know. You never know, do you? You know, I think so.
Last time I've seen Cosmo, he was eating leaves.
Yeah, I was eating a lot of leaves.
You know, from knowing him to be like this, then to like, you know, eating leaves. Yeah. It was kind of, now you're kind of back to middle.
I'm middle ground now.
Middle-ish, yeah.
I've still got some Christmas weight left.
No, I wouldn't say, not at all. Like,
you still keeping the shape? You still boxing, are you?
Still walking away, man, out in New York.
It's funny because Barry's actually a much better boxer than I will ever be.
Yeah, I wanted to play arm and Nick was like, no, I wrote him for you. And I was like, yeah, but I want to play arm. And then he told me Cosmo was, and it kind of made sense. I was like, yeah, that makes sense now.
And finally, can you give us any kind of tease of what to expect from Marvel's Eternals?
It's going to be special, you know, if you've seen Chloe Zhao, the writer.
Amazing film, absolutely.
You know, so just... let your mind go to what she could do with the Eternals because she's going to nail it.
And I saw on your Instagram you've been working out with Kumail Nanjiani.
Yeah.
Insane
shape. Oh, Kumail is... what a legend he is. Yeah, he's a legend.
Yeah. It's a crazy cast across the board, that one, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say it's a pinch me moment and I still won't realise that until it comes out, probably. Yeah. You know, and it'll be a nice feeling then.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for your time, Kate.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, huge congratulations on the film.
That's Cosmo and Barry discussing the characters Arm and Dimna. I absolutely love this film. I know you're a bit on the fence, Jack.
More so than you, yes.
Yeah. So shall I tell you what I loved about it?
Please.
I thought it was really refreshing, interesting to see this sort of crime thriller being played out in this sort of rural Irish location where literally the baddies live on a sort of fish farm and people drive really crap cars around, and it's quite a poor sort of environment, and yet there's this sort of Goodfellas-esque swagger of Dimmler. And I loved that sort of juxtaposition of that. And I just thought the performance by Cosmo Jarvis was absolutely amazing, that he's playing this huge lunk of a guy who's a former boxer who hasn't reached his potential, has ended up in this sort of cul-de-sac being this sort of enforcer for this horrible clan, and torn between the family that he has with his little boy and his girlfriend and this servitude to this gang, and that sort of push-pull of that emotional push-pull. And I think he really does a lot with very little words. So I thought it was actually a performance that we might look back on as the sort of thing that breaks him out.
Yeah, it's a star-making performance from him. He is fantastic in it, I thought. You know, they refer to him as a dog in multiple times because he is this kind of not particularly intelligent enforcer character. And sometimes when he sits up, he looks like a boxer dog or something. Mm. You know, he's really, he's huge.
He's just ginormous.
There's one scene where he's in tears and it's just one long take, and it's fantastic. He's so mesmerizing in it. I really enjoyed his story in the film and his characters. I thought the gang weren't particularly scary, or I don't know, there was something about it that
you would be totally cool with being beaten up and like your face smashed through a coffee table. That would be like not scary to you.
No, that is scary. It just somehow...
I mean, they are murderous as well.
They are. The violence, maybe it was a lot. It felt almost juxtaposed with the film, you know, the tenderness of his character and stuff in a way that kind of didn't work for me. It felt like there were two things battling each other in the film, the violence and then this very tender story. And I was invested in the tender story. And I know it was, you know, that was the point of it.
But that's what life is like.
But I didn't like
it's
that.
It's not all one thing. Life is that. You have to have the juxtaposition of can be having a great day and then something shit happens. And that's also the fact that these people are like, their circumstances are dictated by economics. And
I get it. I think my main problem with it, because I enjoyed it. I was very much in the middle, kind of like, was enjoying most of it, but found some of it perhaps a bit tiresome. I think Barry's character...
That is a strong word, tiresome.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't the most engaged with this film. I think Barry's performance, I think he's a really great actor. But I think here, there was something about it where he was almost trying to be menacing, and it just didn't quite work. I never felt like he was a real threat. Even in a pub when he bashes someone over the head with a glass, it kind of felt so fake, and that I never saw him as a threat, and therefore never really saw like the
I need Matt to jump in here. Come on, please. This is a great film, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm very much on Jane's side of the fence with this film. In that, yeah, I think partly to not just completely attack Jack's opinions.
No, please do.
But to me, that kind of that contrast between the toughness and tenderness was almost completely the point, really. It's such an insane physical transformation. He's literally like a cube of muscle, and there's no differentiation between his neck and his head. He's just like very much hulked out for this. But the fact there is that tenderness underneath, and also there is that contradiction, and you are willing him to kind of do the right thing.
You want the best for him, don't you? You want him to make the right choice, and he keeps making very poor life choices, which is so tense. I mean, one of the things I found about it, I was so on edge by the time the film had finished, because it's got this really sort of propulsive score by Blank Mass. It's fast editing. There's a car chase in it with an absolute banger of a car over a sort of Irish country lane, but it's incredibly tense. I just think it works on that level, that, as you're saying, that sort of nuance that he brings to it, the sweetness and the wanting to do better is all wrapped up in that brutal, raw, violent and propulsive film.
And just to offer the opposite thought to another of Jack's comments is, I actually felt with Barry, his boyishness really worked with this role, because he's obviously young and he's got a very boyish look to him. But I kind of felt you're supposed to see this character as he's immature. He's confined
a big fish in a small pond,
isn't
he?
Yeah, exactly. And he's confined by his own circumstances in a similar way to how Arm is, really. And he's... Yeah. While he doesn't deal with it, and perhaps doesn't, you don't quite have that same sensitivity as Arm has, Dimpner is kind of trapped by this family that he's born into, and the expectations on the kind of men in the family. So I think the fact that he looks young, I almost didn't expect to find him super scary. It's almost more the fact that, yeah, he's having to fulfill this role, even if he doesn't necessarily want to.
And that violence is just a part of their sort of life, and that's what you're expected to do.
I get that. I get all of this. And I see the juxtaposition is the point of it, but I'm just not the biggest fan of those kind of movies, those kind of like gritty, especially like low budget British films that kind of go on that way. It's very much felt like it was going for like a Lynn Ramsey feel in parts, especially with some of the editing. Really reminded me of You Were Never Really Here in parts, especially, you know, there's one bit where he literally has a hammer as well in this film, and it felt like echoes from that film. But I loved that Lynn Ramsey film. I thought it was amazing. I thought Joaquin's great in it. And here you've got Cosmo. But there was something like the story wasn't quite as... that everything that surrounded it, I wanted just to be with Cosmo and just concentrate on him. And some of the diversions with kind of Barry's character and stuff, I don't know. There was, it just didn't quite work for me in a way. Like, I think Cosmo's so pulling and so mesmerizing as a performance that I just wanted to stay with him the whole time. And then everything else kind of felt just like a slight level down. But I think that was just what he brought to the screen as well. And he's so fantastic. There was a lot going on there as well. So in the film, because he's a former boxer and he has this child with another lady, and they're kind of distant from each other as well, and the child is autistic, I believe. So there's a whole other relationship going on there. And it was almost like the film is not hugely long, it's 1 hour and 40 or so, but then you've got so many relationships at play here that balancing like the wife and the kid, and then not the wife, the girlfriend, and the ex-girlfriend having another boyfriend as well, and all these things in play. It felt like so much that some of it didn't quite work as well as other bits. Like, I would perhaps would have liked to have seen Cosmo's character like fighting the boyfriend or something like that.
Jack, I feel like we're learning a lot about you today.
What do you mean learning a lot about me?
You want to see people fight their suitors.
No, I think that was very much bubbling there. You know, they kind of went from that, and then there would be a scene where they're on a cliff face or something. And I get that that's... the juxtaposition again is there. I don't know. I felt like I was being yanked about, perhaps.
I liked that. Mm. And I think, you know, this is a first-time director, Nick Rowland, who had made a short film that was BAFTA nominated, and this is his first feature film. I just think it's incredibly accomplished and just, you know, is such a great calling card to what he might do with an even bigger budget and bigger scope. I think what he's managed to achieve here is amazing.
For Nick and Cosmo, I think, it definitely feels like you really want to know what they're going to do next. And it really feels like one of those films that just signifies the arrival of kind of new talent that you're going to keep your eye on.
Okay, so we gave it 4 stars in total film. So, Jack, you're in the minority.
Yeah, I mean, I would have gone probably 3-star. I feel like I've been harsh. I'm just trying to play devil's advocate, I think, because there was a lot I really enjoyed about the film. So I think maybe I've come off as being harsh, but I did have a good time with it for the most part.
Okay, so we can thoroughly recommend, not talking about Jack, but we can thoroughly recommend Calm with Horses, which is out this Friday, the 13th of March. So from one male relationship to another, let's take a look at this.
Come on, Joan.
You decide, Daddy.
English solo cigarette.
Italian Nazi. Promonomentori undai, dai ge.
Bitu ara ries sakme shen tu sato ver gaige katso shen, ha?
3, 4, kaush.
So that was a clip from And Then We Danced, which I haven't seen, but you two both had. So Jane, do you want to tell me what it's about?
It's about a young man who's a dancer in a Georgian national dance company who is really striving to be the best in the company and wanting to take the lead role, but sort of is doubted by his teacher. And within that arc comes this new student who takes his eye, a young man who comes from a different town and is really a great natural dancer. So he's his competitor, but at the same time, he feels very drawn to him. And it's about the sort of halting romance that goes on between those two boys. Within that competitive arena, but also in Georgia, which is very anti-gay. Being gay is not okay. They're very strict, very conservative, and Georgian dance itself is very masculine. He's constantly told, you're too soft. There's no sex in Georgian dance. Be more manly. So it's this sort of battle that he's sort of fighting from a professional point of view and a personal one.
Yeah, that sums up pretty well. This is similar to a previous podcast where themes are sort of shared between the films that are coming out in that week. Yeah, kind of like Calm with Horses, there's expectation and the pressure on, you know, these men to live up to these certain standards that are expected of them. But yeah, it's a very, very engrossing film. And one of the great things really about any film is when it can just draw you into a world you just don't know much about. And as you were saying, Georgia is a country I'm not at all familiar with. And yeah, to just get a glimpse into that world from the perspective of this dance group. And the dancing itself, the Georgian dancing.
It's amazing.
It's incredible. Kind of very much in the ballet style of dancing.
But super athletic.
Yeah, very athletic. Very kind of, as you were saying, they say it's very masculine, but it is very aggressive. They're really throwing their bodies around and jumping in just such a kind of forceful manner. I mean, that side of it's just sort of fascinating enough, let alone when you actually get then absorbed into Merab's story and the kind of the relationships he's got. And again, another film where there's a few different relationships, like he's initially with a woman who's another dancer at the company, obviously he's drawn to this new guy that you mentioned, but then his brother's also a dancer and he's very different to him. And I actually found that one of the most interesting strands, how that played out with him and his
brother. It's like what you said, because both his parents were former dancers and had been very good in their time. So he and his brother have had to come through this expectation of the dance world that they will be as good as their parents. And his brother obviously isn't interested. He desperately is, but isn't quite good enough. It's that sort of artistic endeavour. What do you do if the thing you really want to do is something that you just can't get to the level you want to get? And at the same time, the thing you want to do, which is be with this man, is something that is totally frowned upon. So he's sort of fighting this horrible battle of emotional and professional all the time.
This sounds like it's going to be a very emotional film.
I loved it so much. And it really, really reminded me of Call Me By Your Name, which, as you know, is one of my favourites. Very similar arc to the characters and similar filmmaking, in as much as the way this sort of relationship unfurls is just delightful and is very slow burn, and you really want them to get together, and it's massively romantic and passionate, and yeah, I loved it.
And there's actually a really interesting story behind the scenes as well, because in the magazine we interviewed Levon Akin, and he was talking about basically how they had to almost film in a guerrilla style because the sort of themes and topics being frowned upon in that country. So you realise how much was at stake behind the camera. That kind of just adds an extra sort
they
of
had
dimension
death threats
to it
and all
as well.
Sorts from sort of conservative groups. They had protesters. And, you know, Levan Gelbakiani, who plays Merab, he realises that in taking on this role, he sort of opened himself up to a lot of criticism from people in Georgia. Mm, yeah. And he's a professional dancer. And you can obviously see that there's no way he could have taken on this role and faked the dancing. He's a dancer first and then he became the actor. But he's so good.
He's very natural, isn't he?
Yeah, he's amazing. So expressive.
And he almost had a sort of a young Tom Hiddleston quality about him. Mm. I don't know if it's just kind of his build and the sort of wavy hair and kind of pointy, handsome features. But yeah, there was definitely something a bit Hiddleston about him, I felt.
Yeah, he's very good.
What's the setting like? So I don't really know Georgia very well, but like Calm with Horses was very rural islands, that kind of bleakness in the cinematography as well. What was this film perhaps in comparison? Was it very bright and colourful?
No, it's kind of similar, in as much as, you know, that nobody has a lot of money. You know, the two boys sleep on sofas in their grandma's house. They go to a friend's house, don't they? And they say she's really rich, but actually the house has like got window panes out of it. And comparatively from what we might expect a rich person's house to look like, it doesn't feel that way. And
it doesn't feel like it goes down the poverty porn angle.
No, it's
either.
Not poverty porn.
Again, very naturalistic in the cinematography, I guess.
But you can see why Merab is so keen for this dancing to work out, because that's his ticket off his grandma's sofa. And yeah, you sort of see it's very cityscape. It's not rural. And it's just quite interesting. I knew nothing about Georgia. Same. So I've been frantically Googling Georgia, like the dinners they're eating, like what is it that they're having? There's black cherries there. When do they have that? What kind of cheese is that? It's just really fascinating to go somewhere in a film and see this whole other country and society.
You both loved it then?
Yeah. And we gave it 4 stars in total film. So it's another 4-star nailed on.
That's what I would give it, yeah, 4. How about you?
Couldn't even verge into the 5 territory, to be honest. I think it's going to be in my top 10 of the year at the end of the year.
So big talk.
Who is it for fans of?
If you like Call Me By Your Name, sort of the romance of that and the trajectory of that, this would work for you. But equally, if you liked Black Swan and the idea of brutal regime that it takes to be a top dancer, it works on that level.
Could even say something like Rocky, I suppose, because this underdog story, someone training really hard as a means to escape their slightly impoverished life in a poor city.
Yeah.
So yeah, even you could draw that kind of comparison.
The sweat it takes to escape.
Yeah.
Just no Eye of the Tiger. A lot of drumming and Georgian music, no Eye of the Tiger, just to be clear.
I wonder if the filmmakers ever thought their film would be compared to Rocky.
There you go. That's a poster quote for them, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Shall we move on? That's also out this Friday, but there's another film out this Friday that has been quite controversial and was pulled and is now back on the menu. It's this one.
What is happening? What is all of this?
Did you see that article? Every year, these liberal elites kidnap a bunch of normal folks like us and hunt us for sport.
The last I heard, free speech still exists.
Don't First Amendment me.
It wasn't real.
So that's The Hunt, which was supposed to come out 4 months ago, was pulled due to shootings in El Paso and Daytona, and also managed to get some tweetage from Donald Trump. What's it about? Why is it so controversial, Jack?
So it's about a group of so-called deplorables, which is what they're called in the film, who are brought to basically a huge estate, and then they are hunted by a group of rich people.
Liberal rich people.
Liberal rich people. Yeah, as the movie unfolds, we kind of realise that there's one main character who's this woman played by Betty Gilpin, who is just trying to survive. As it progresses, they do more and more outrageous things, the liberal wealthy people, to hunt her down, and it kind of goes into some very strange territory.
It's kind of like a super violent Hunger Games in some regard, in a very basic level, isn't it? Because, yeah, you get these 12 people dropped off in this weird environment. You don't really know where you are at first, this sort of outdoorsy environment. You're not even entirely sure what country you're in. And they're given a load of weapons, basically. And then, so they're given a slight sporting chance,
you could
say.
Like Hard Target or The Purge.
Well, yeah. It is actually from Blumhouse Pictures, who produce the Purge movie, so it has that sort of great idea, fairly low budget, let's just go for it kind of feel to it that a lot of the Blumhouse movies have.
Yeah, it's an interesting film. There's a lot of loaded political language in it. I mean, I've already mentioned deplorables, but obviously like snowflakes get a mention, all this kind of stuff. You know, at one point one of the liberal characters jokes how that one of their tweets was liked by Ava DuVernay. Yeah, it's
very knowing.
Yeah,
to a real extreme, actually, as well. Not just, these aren't just casual nods. This is just completely baked in throughout, isn't it? And they're kind of competing over how woke they all are. And there's a lot of talk about that kind of thing. So it very much addresses it sort of head on. It's not hidden or slightly metaphorical. It's just right out there at the
front.
So
there's nothing subtle about this. This is sledgehammer politics being put through the sort of satire. Is it a satire? How are we describing this?
It's hard to explain.
Well, it's kind of, I guess, I would call it a satirical thriller, I suppose. And for me personally, I actually found it enjoyable enough in the moment. I actually thought it was entertaining. It was quite funny in places. And there was a lot of inventive action and kind of some fun kills and things like that. And I actually did find, especially the first couple of acts, I did find it quite tense because you are just thrown into this situation and you're kind of running along with these characters, not really entirely sure what's going on, just knowing that they're being hunted. But it's one of those films that, to me, afterwards, it really evaporated almost immediately. And I didn't think its satirical points were sort of sharp enough. It was very, like you say, very sledgehammer to no real end, I found, to no kind of satisfying satirical point. It was,
yeah, I'm not really sure what point it was trying to make. It was kind of almost criticizing everyone, but without any kind of anything to back it up. I don't know, it, you know, throwing out these terms quite loosely. I enjoyed it while I was watching it. It was quite a fun romp. You know, there were some very gory deaths and great fight scenes. Betty Gilpin's really good in it. I thought she played Minnesotan lady who's not the cleverest, but, you know, she's a former soldier in America, so she's got skills.
There's always one, isn't there?
But, it, afterwards it did fall hollow. You know, I don't know what it was really trying to say, and it wasn't very nuanced in any way. And it's a short film as well.
Yeah, this never happens to me, but basically I checked my watch towards the end of the film because it felt so short. Like when I realised we were kind of approaching the final showdown, I actually looked at my watch and thought, wait, we can't actually have reached the sort of final act already. And we had, basically.
So it's short, trashy, throwaway. And do you think it would have got the attention that it has now had it not been sort of unfortunately connected to news events? Would it have sunk without trace in another time zone?
I don't think it would have sunk without a trace. I think there's a real Blumhouse quality to it. It very much falls into the ballpark of their other films, that low budget, slightly trashy, but still quite fun.
And with a sort of water cooler sort of element to it, where it does feel kind of interesting to talk about it. And yeah, there is that sort of talking point at the centre, but yeah, it just doesn't really hold up.
Yeah, I don't think it would be getting this level of attention. You know, if you've got Donald Trump tweeting about it to his however many million people,
That's publicity you can't buy, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
We gave it 2 stars. Jordan Farley said it was 2 stars, and it makes The Purge appear nuanced and layered with complexity compared to the blunt force approach here.
I think I had more fun with it than Jordan. I'd fall more into 3-star line, but kind of a low to middling 3-star.
Yeah, and I'd probably be on the 2-3 border, as we sometimes say. Yeah, so
a trashy 90-minute, this is the one for you.
Yeah, if you want to turn your brain off from everything that's going on in the world, but then also have it thrown in your face.
Yeah. that doesn't feel like the right solution. Okay, so that is The Hunt, which is also out this Friday. Shall we move on? Shall we get ready for our swimwear section, ladies?
This competition makes us compete with each other and makes the world narrower for all of us in the end. Why should any woman have to earn her place in the world by looking a particular way? You don't. He doesn't. Why should we?
Okay, so this is Misbehaviour, which is about beauty queens and women's libbers clashing during Miss World in the 1970 contest that happened in London. Tell me more.
You set up the historical context there. It's 1970 Miss World competition, which takes place in London. And there's a few different story strands to follow. Like, it's very much an ensemble film, but if we're going to say there's a main character, you'd perhaps say Keira Knightley, who plays Sally Alexander, who was a real person. And at this point in time, she's an aspiring academic trying to break into a very male-dominated world. We see her right at the beginning going for this interview for a history post, and it's an all-male panel. She's also struggling with juggling her sort of childcare needs and all that kind of stuff. So she's our first entry point really into the film. And she ends up joining this women's liberation group who basically are looking to disrupt this Miss World competition with kind of staging a protest, basically. And other strands we kind of follow, there's Gugu Mbatha-Raw, who plays Jennifer Hostin, who's Miss Grenada, and she's kind of competing, obviously, in the contest. And as a black competitor, there's obviously controversy around that because it's very largely white at this point in time. I think there's only one other black competitor.
There are two Miss South Africas, aren't there? But there's Miss South Africa and Miss Africa South.
Yeah.
One's a white lady and one's a black lady. There's controversy there as well.
And it's presided over by Bob Hope.
Yeah, played by Greg Kinnear in a prosthetic nose. And it's all basically organised by Julia and Eric Morley, who are played by Keely Hawes and Risa Fans, who are kind of, yeah, the long-time organisers of the contest. So you're following all these different people, and it's all converging towards this disruption at the 1970 contest.
Like, there's also Bob Hope's wife, Dolores Hope, who's played by Leslie Manville in a quite underutilized role for Leslie. She's such a fantastic
actress.
And
you've got Jessie Buckley.
And you've got Jessie Buckley as one of the Women's Liberation Group members, who's very down with the patriarchy and very active. And she's also got an activist group as well. There's a lot going on in this film.
There is. Yeah,
it sounds like there's a lot to follow. And is there any real point made with it?
Every scene kind of puts something different in your mind. You know, you're very much, you know, you're very against the Miss World competition for the most of it. But then suddenly Gugu's character will say something that's actually for the Miss World competition. And then there's Keira Knightley's character's mother, who's also fighting kind of past issues with the patriarchy and stuff. And they take on a lot of targets and they make a lot of points. And it's interesting, but I'm not sure. I don't really know where the film lands itself. I feel like
I was just gonna say that it doesn't quite pick a side, does it? Because it obviously shows you that there are these benefits to when these underrepresented women are getting this platform. They don't want to completely come down and say Miss World is a terrible thing, so they don't want to also completely condone the disruption.
Feels a bit soft.
It is, and in its favor, it is very watchable. I found it easy to watch, sort of a lot of likeable performances. Like, as Jack mentioned, it's a crazy cast and there's a lot of good performers in there.
Great 70s fashion.
Yeah, and it's just a very light, easy watch. Perhaps you could have made such a different film out of this, obviously. You could have made so much more gritty, intense kind of drama out of it, but it very much goes for the light. You could imagine watching it on TV. It has that sort of feel to it that it sort of feels like it's designed to appeal as widely as possible, really, rather than having any sort of rough edges. Yeah, I found that for that reason, not all of it blows really landed, and some of the supporting turns are very broad. They feel very sort of TV comedy, like Risa Fans in particular. I found that he was just a bit too much almost, and I wasn't overly keen on Greg Kinnear's Bob Hope either. It just felt a bit on the nose,
The nose.
It's quite kind of like fun and camp in places, but then concentrating all these very serious issues. It feels like a film that just needed to be focused more. It just needed that kind of a central strand rather than, like, Keira Knightley is kind of the main character, but also there's Gugu, who's also kind of the main character. And, you know, she's front and center in the posters as well. Mm. So it's implied that she's the main person, but she's not really. She's like, that's almost like the B story to it. But then there's also the C story of, like, Leslie Manville's character. Yeah. And then there's Keely Hawes's character, who's also quite a main player, who's like another D story. And all these women who are making different points. And it's like, I would have rather have spent longer with fewer of them rather than kind of trying to be so scattershot about it.
Or it could have possibly been a mini series even.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that would have been interesting for sure.
But to follow each strand of each character and actually give it the time it deserves.
And just dig into it a bit more. Because some of the issues, you're kind of, they're thrown at you. You're like, oh, I didn't even really have time to sort of think about that. And
But let's also be in praise of the fact that this is once again another week where we've got a film that's led by women and directed by a woman.
About, and produced and written.
Yeah, and it's really encouraging to see that there.
And again, this is obviously a slightly patronising turn of phrase, but it definitely feels like its heart is in the right place. You're sort of willing it to be good because, you know, it does feel like a film with the sort of best intentions. Mm. But yeah, it just doesn't always land.
Well, we gave it 3 stars. Is that fair?
I would say that's fair.
Yeah, I would agree. It feels like it's destined to start a conversation, and I think it will.
And it's good for little girls to see that sort of different versions of women up on screen, not just women in bathing suits. So out of our list of this week, which is quite a mixed bag, we've got The Hunt, Misbehaviour, And Then We Danced, and Calm With Horses, and Bloodshot, Whisper It. Who knows? What would you be sending people to, Jack?
See, as much as I was ragging on it earlier, it probably would be Calm With Horses.
Calm With Horses.
Now he's back on it. Yeah, for me, it would definitely be Calm With Horses, because I'd be saying, look, come on, watch this before these guys explode and you can be in on the ground floor and see where they were at first.
Yeah, I agree. Calm With Horses is my choice for this week. So shall we move on and do a reader's question?
There are more questions than answers, and the more I find out, the less I know. Yeah, the more I find out, the less I know.
Okay, so Ruth Archer wants to know how far ahead we put the magazine together, and was it too late to pull our No Time to Die cover, which is now on shelves?
Thanks obviously, for drawing attention to that, Ruth.
Yeah, in case you've missed it, No Time to Die was pushed back to November, and our current issue has that on the cover because we thought it was coming out next month. Mm. So, Matt, do you want to answer that?
Yeah, well, in very simple terms, we actually put the magazine to bed, as we would say, pretty much 2 weeks before it actually goes on sale on shelves. And obviously we're working on it quite a while before then, especially when it comes to arranging covers and big interviews and things like that, and all these kind of set visits. So we'd have had to have known a real long time ago about No Time to Die to really have time to change it.
Mm.
But this news was announced when it was already at the printers.
It was at the printers.
We had literally received our copies in the office, which we normally get a few days early.
I think subscribers had received theirs as
well. Yeah, we were all very excited by it. It's genuinely, if you haven't read it yet, is a great feature by Jordan Farley, who went on a couple of set visits, got great interviews just
got
across
great
the board.
Access, yeah.
And yeah, it's still, so I highly recommend reading it. But obviously we're a bit gutted when that news comes out. But
it doesn't change the fact that, you know, you can still read about it now and be excited about it and know it's still incoming. It hasn't been, like, taken away. It's not like it's never coming out. It's just down the road.
And as all our features are, really, it's completely non-spoilery. So there's nothing to fear on that level if you're sort of nervous about reading it before seeing the film.
And but also, we will revisit it before it comes out, just to remind you of what's happening with the film by the time we come around to November.
And it's also funny as well, because we're talking about this now, when The Hunt was another one where we actually ran an interview with the director of the magazine. And again, in between the time of going to press and the magazine actually hitting shelves, the film had been completely pulled. So again, it's like this weird relic.
It's not the first time this has happened. It happens a lot. Either films move or people die, we've had, or people disgrace themselves. Mm. And there's nothing you can do. But those things are just part of the process.
Yeah, it's not quite like the internet where you can just change it instantly.
Pull it down, Jack. Yeah, can't do anything. It's on the shelf. It's in the vans. It's going out. So, but we hope you enjoy the magazine and enjoy the feature and just look forward to November like Christmas.
I'm so excited for Bond
now. I'm
still
super excited. Well, yeah. In fact, I feel like it's given me even more delayed gratification because I was really excited that I was going to see it. But now I'm going to be screaming by the time that theme tune starts and I'm sitting in the dark watching it. I'm just going to be so you're ready for it.
The thing for me is knowing that No Time to Die must be finished somewhere in the world. There's like, it's going to be out there for months, just sitting there without being unwatched.
But will they be able to resist tinkering with it in this extra time they've got? Yeah. I mean, that's the thing with filmmakers. They often edit right up to the wire and then they put it out there and it has to go at the deadline. Will they start tinkering with it, I wonder?
Kerry Joji Fukunaga, who's the director of No Time to Die, he actually tweeted a video the other day of his calendar on his computer and showing how empty it is for the next few months and how full it has been in this editing process. So maybe we'll just shove it in a vault and
go on holiday,
sleep on it,
go and enjoy himself. So that issue is on sale now. And just to remind you, if you would like to buy a subscription, which we'd love you if you did, you can get 10% off total film subscriptions with the code INSIDETF when you go to checkout at www.myfavouritemagazines.co.uk. That's it from us. We'll be back next week. Say goodbye, Matt.
Bye.
Say goodbye, Jack.
Goodbye.
And goodbye for me.